Okay. thank you for coming. On the 20th of, on the 6th of November, 2 weeks ago, I got an email from two Knesset members. It was immediately after the Shalit release, and they wrote, "We want to write a draft about the next time. What should be the process, what should be the principles, and we want it to be part of the Israeli law." And Tzohar, the rabbis of Tzohar, as I explained on Shabbos, really tried to expand the fields that we are dealing with. And therefore, we are working a lot in the Knesset, helping and advising Knesset members from all parties, even the very left anti-religion parties, to make the law of Israel more Jewish. So therefore, we were asked by the Knesset to write a paper, what is a Jewish law about Gilad Shalit? I'm reading my response. I want to see the details. Okay? Ani chayav lirot, I'm one of the strange people that don't speak about something that they don't know. So let me see the draft, and I'll try to understand. And I didn't know I'm going to speak about this issue here, and I didn't realize that they'll answer. This morning, and Jay can testify, I got the email, you know, especially for you. I got an email from these two Knesset members, and they wrote to me the following. I'll try to translate it. We want that in the Israeli law will be written, first of all, in order to release prisoners, you'll have to have a big majority in the Knesset, 75 or 80% of the Knesset members that will vote in order to agree to release murderers for Israeli soldiers. Second, every terrorist that will be released will have to write a letter that he is apologizing, or he is litcharet, I don't know how you say, regret, and will a commitment that or obligation that he will not go back into terror. Third, someone that was already released on sometimes ago, some years ago, and again came back to terror, will never be released again. Four, the state will have to the families that were injured will have the right to appeal, and the state will have to listen to them. It will be to question them and to give them the opportunity to express their opinion. And this is approximately the idea of the new law. So I feel really, really hashgoche that this email I received this morning, it's 20th November 6:06:45. I mean, 6:45 in the morning, Canada time. And it's really a feel that Hashem sent it, you know, to our session. Because I'm not going to speak about things that everybody spoke about. I'm not going to speak about Gilad Shalit, what happened, what was the discussion, because I think last night, and everybody knows, that actually all arguments that were made and all the ideas that was said were reasonable. I mean, really, no one said something that is not that is out of the borders of saying something logic, and it's really a big debate. I want to speak about the next time. Im Yirtzeh Hashem will never face it, but what conclusions can we make towards the next time? But I'm asking you to listen carefully for the next 10 minutes, because you can ask me, who are you? What do you understand? And what is your? Why are you better in those issues than anyone else that can think this way or that way? And why do I think that I represent Yahadut or whatever that is related to this Gilad Shalit? And it's a good question. My answer will be, I'm not going to speak in the next 10 minutes on Gilad Shalit. I'm going to share with you something that is completely different from my expertise, from my work in Israel and the ethical committees in Israel. And I'll try, you know, to say something new and to transfer my experience from one case that it doesn't have anything to do with Gilad Shalit into Gilad Shalit's case or next time case, and I hope that, as I said before, I want you to go out from this session, to go home with something new that you didn't hear or didn't meet. It's not that I have the wisdom, and it's not that I'm the Chacham HaGadol, but something that I usually claim, that if you transfer experience from one field to other to another field, your thoughts are being richer, and you may think completely in a different way. As I said before, Tzohar rabbis decided years ago, immediately after Rabin's assassination, to try to change the image and the field and the discourse where the Rabbanim are working. We are not dealing only with weddings, conversions, Shabbos, whatever. We are going to be Rabbanim L'Klal Yisrael that are trying to deal with all the fields that are actually building the State of Israel from anything, but we should be professional. I decided 16 years ago to become an expert in ethics. I didn't learn even one day in university. All my life I was in the yeshiva. But also, I think, I hope that everybody believes that also the Torah has something to say about ethics. And I became more and more involved in ethics committees. Therefore, I was appointed to a few medical bioethics committees or commissions in Israel, and not only bioethics. Also the presidential of the press media, press council. I'm part of the presidential press media, press council that deals with ethical questions in the media, etc., etc., etc. I think one of the really very impressive appointments that I was part of the in 2008, in 2009, I was part of the basket medicine committee. That means the committee that decides what medicine will the government provide for free. And in Israel, it's the process is the following. The committee gets the budget. It was 450 million shekel. Approximately, you can 150 million American dollars, approximately, and the list of medicine of new technology is approximately $1.5 billion. So actually, we'll have to take one of four, or one of three, between three and four new medicine to include. Every decision to include someone, something, some technology means to exclude the other. Okay? And these are questions of death and life. No doubts, because the question is to include medicine against cancer, against cardiology, or quality of life. And it's amazing. It's a lot of work, a lot of reading, but the decisions are very, very hard. And actually, I can very briefly say what were the five great questions, but I'm going to speak only about the fifth one. The first debate, the big debates. The first one is to include medicine that are dealing with quality of life. Because if you include quality of life, you exclude medicine that deal with the life, not quality of life, but with life. So this is one of the great questions and issues that we were there. The second one is, if there, it's a kind of disease that the patient, it's his fault. It's his fault, let's say, because he didn't prevent himself with sex and he got sick because of that. Should he pay more? Should he pay? And it's a big conversation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are all kinds of different questions. The fifth one, I'll make a long story short, is what we call orphan disease. And these are diseases that there are less than 30,000 patients all over the world with this disease, and therefore no medicine company is willing to invest money in order to produce medicine against this disease. If they do it, the price is, you know, outrageous. It's really, the price is no one, even rich people, even very wealthy people, can't afford. Okay? One of those diseases is the Hunter disease. I don't know, my English is not good enough in order to describe everything, but the Hunter disease means that the body can't melt the fat. Therefore, the child is becoming more and more fat, but it's also squeezed in, and it squeezes his liver and his lungs and whatever, and his heart, and he dies, and it's awful. There are three kids in Israel that are sick in this disease, the Hunter disease. The price of the medicine for three children is, first year, 5 million shekel. That means more than 1% of the 450 shekel that the committee actually got from the government. That means, only in order to demonstrate that if we'll include this medicine, so 1%, more than 1% of the budget will be in order to save three children's life only. I can say the word only. So if we'll continue, so the whole 100% will save only 900 people. Okay? If 1% is 3, so 100% is that's all. 300 patients. Okay? So, and the problem is that because it's a kind of disease that the amount of medicine you need is a result of your weight. So if this kid is growing up, so next year it will be 8 million shekel, and a year later 12 million shekel, and whatsoever, he'll die at the age of 26. Even with the medicine, between 24, 26, I mean, you know, it's statistics, you never know. But this is what we know about this disease. Okay, guys, to include it or not to include it. And what's worse is that one of those kids is my neighbor. I know him. He's my neighbor. He lives in Efrat. I didn't know it in advance. But he's my neighbor. So it's not anonymous. It's not a theoretical question. It's someone that you know, that you meet in the street. You see the kid. In the meantime, he got the medicine from the company for free until the government, until the committee of the government will decide. So he got the medicine for free. So you look and you see he's getting narrow every thinner. Every time you meet him, and he's starting to smile, and he's walking, he's whatever. And you have now to decide. But don't forget, including this medicine means excluding not only other medicine, but numbers of patients that will be rescued, that will be able to get the medicine in order to live. I'm not talking about quality of life. I'm talking about medicine against cancer and against illness that really kill people. I mean, people are dying from it. And I think it's a similar question. It's a similar question to Gilad Shalit. Therefore, when you make some transportations from those different discourses, actually, maybe these thoughts are, maybe you will promote your abilities to think a little bit differently and to ask yourself all kinds of questions. Another fact, and that's the last thing, this committee, there are 16 members in this committee, and our custom was, I don't know what's the situation today, I'm out of it, but our custom was that we're trying not to vote. We're trying that, you know, that the decision will be made by all 16, everybody will agree, we'll make compromises and concessions, and it works. Even because people are very sensitive, are very careful, it's questions of life and death, and most of them are based on statistics, because usually you don't know the patients. So therefore, we do succeed to convince, and we do succeed to argue and to come eventually to a decision that everybody will be. It's a win-win game. Usually, there were only three decisions that we voted, And on this particular one, we voted because we weren't able to come to a decision, and the vote, you know what, I'll ask you, guess. What was the result? What was the decision? No. It's really something unbelievable that eventually, after all kinds of, we voted, and it was 13 against 3 to include this medicine. But even those that supported the idea to include this medicine felt something is wrong. And then they started to add to the decision all kinds of conditions. Two kinds of conditions. One is, we are calling the government and we are announcing it's the last time we'll include this kind of medicine, and next time the government will have to find an external budget in order to confront and face these challenges, because we can't anymore continue. If you continue in this way, next year we'll include another medicine against what we call orphan disease, and then it will be already 10 million or 20 million or 50 million shekel, and actually it's neglecting the other patients. So that's one thing. And people feel that if we today will make decisions that next time it will be different, and then we'll be prepared, and we will have we'll finally we'll say that the decision should be, we'll expect accept no we'll nikabel akhlata no accept a different decision next time. So people, I think, are lying to themselves. I can assure you, I'm not there anymore. I said I was only in 2008, 2009. I couldn't do it anymore because it's really a lot of material to read and a lot of work, and you don't get paid for it. So it's volunteering. So I did it for 2 years and not anymore. But I think that people are lying to themselves that next time something will be different. That's the one conclusion I want to make. So I'm asking myself regarding Gilad Shalit, it's the same issue. What can we do that next time will be different, if we should do things that next time will be different? It's, first of all, if we should. But let's say, as I said, even those that supported the idea to include this medicine had to ask themselves what will be the next time. And I think they cheated themselves. I think if they didn't have the courage this time to make the real conclusions and to accept the real decision that should be made, trying to say that next time someone else will be able, or even if we know the patient, will be have the courage not to include this medicine, I think it will not work. So therefore, if we are preparing ourselves, chas v'shalom, not preparing chas v'shalom, preparing ourselves to an occasion that chas v'shalom will appear again, I hope that one thing we should do, in my opinion, is that we shouldn't cheat ourselves, and we'll ask ourselves, what, after saying that, and nevertheless, what can we do in advance in order to do those things? That's one thing. The second thing is that because of this decision of including the medicine against the Hunter disease in the basket, or the medicine basket, as we call it, there are a lot of meanings. There were a lot of consequences, because then other diseases that we rejected before said, okay, if you are including for those three children the medicine, so try to be coherent. And if you'll try to be coherent, you have to ask yourself, what are the consequences of every decision? And usually in ethics, this is the situation. You make one decision and you are very proud of yourself that you oh, finally, after a big discussion, you make the decisions, but, and you get to, let's say, the majority really supported to include this medicine, but then you discover that there are so many consequences. It's like a domino, that everything has influence on something and reflects something else. And I want to say the same thing about Gilad Shalit. Because I'll give you two examples that are really disturbing. The first example is that since Gilad Shalit release in Israel, the main debate is what we call Hannibal. Hannibal is a code to an order of the army that we really don't know if exists or not. I'm a retired major, and I was a commander of a very high-level unit, anti-tank missiles unit, for years. And I don't know if there is such a pkuda or not. Hannibal means that if you see a soldier that was kidnapped, you must shoot immediately towards the group that kidnapped him, even if he will be injured and even if he will die. You have to kill your friend. Because Israel cannot let herself anymore to pay this price. So you see what happened. Because of the highest price that was exposed, it's if this is the moral thing to do in our obligation towards the soldier, and I'm not saying my position. I really don't know why. What I think I know what I would have voted if I was a minister in the government, but it's not important for this session because I'm not going to express my opinions. I want to explain what are the consequences of every decision. And one extreme result of this decision is that more and more soldiers are convinced of it, that there is an order that if you see your friend that is being kidnapped, you should shoot immediately towards the group, even if there's 90% that he will be injured or killed by you. Now, I have a son that is now located near the border, the Egyptian border. The place that will, if kidnap will take place, it will be there. And I'm thinking about him, not only as the captive soldier, I'm thinking about him about standing in an observation point, seeing that one soldier was kidnapped, and shooting. Wow. So this is one result of the decision that usually you don't think about, because you first of all think about the case, but when you deal with ethical questions, you have to ask yourself not only what will be the decision now, you have to ask yourself what are the consequences of your decision. That's one thing. A second thing that was made in Israel, that a result of this decision is that, I'll go back to the medicine basket. We were attacked by the whole committee were attacked that we agreed that emotional thinking and emotional sources took over the rational thinking. Okay? And how can you include, you know, the fact that you decided to include medicine, 5 million shekel for 3 patients, is not logic, is not a consequence of analyzing. It's the fact that you weren't brave enough. Okay? Some of us responded and said, you know what? The Jewish heart is not something that you have to reject. A Jewish heart is something that maybe you should embrace. And you know what? I'm not sure it's a real criticism. That they said that to do things because of your heart is worse than to do things according to making decisions in a logic way. No, it's really every Jewish mother, and I'm not sure about Jewish mother, but I know what's a Jewish father. Also, Jewish father has a heart. Okay? And when, you know, it's really very effective, this argue. But I'm not sure that we want to live in a state that the leadership will work, will take the heart as the priority. Because leadership means, even though emotional, feelings and whatever are very effective, you should do the right thing. So, if you're praising the decision about the, including the Hunter disease and releasing Gilad Shalit, you, in the same time, say that the best or one of the legitimate way to make decisions is to let the heart to talk, even if you know it will cause a lot of damage and a lot of injuries, future injured soldiers. And that's a problem. Now, if you really think that way, seder gamur. But if you don't think that way, so you have to understand that you did it. You did it even though you are against it. So therefore, it's only I wanted to demonstrate, as I said before, that all those kinds of decisions have at least two things that you have to think about. One is the consequences, as I said, about, for example, the Hannibal process. And the second one is the question or the relationship between the heart and your brain. Now let's go back to the Torah. Can we really claim that there is a Torah, we are talking about Torah in motion, Torah opinion towards the question of Gilad Shalit, or towards the question about the Hunter disease? It's the same, as I said, I think it's really very similar. Those two questions are very, very similar. Now, I want to say two things in contrary. The first thing, the first answer is no with a capital N. We can't deny the fact that for the last 2,200 years, we didn't have an independent state. Therefore, we didn't deal with those kind of questions. We didn't have an army. We didn't have captive soldiers. We weren't surrounded. We couldn't fight. Nothing. And 2,200 years is a lot of time. And I think that everybody knows here that if he is asking himself, is permitted on Shabbos to take a frozen schnitzel directly from the freezer and put it on the Shabbos platter, he'll find approximately 40 books that are dealing with this issue. And it's an important, it's my work, I teach it. But if he'll ask himself, when a terrorist surrounds himself with 10 Palestinian children, should he, may I, is it permitted to shoot a missile in order to kill him, but all the 10 kids will be killed again? As far as I know, there's even no one sentence in the Jewish tradition that deals with it. And I'm not criticizing the Jewish tradition. What wasn't relevant wasn't dealt. That's, facts of life. So therefore, trying to take the Mishnah that everybody quoted, En podim et ha-shvuyim yoter mechvi shovyam, that dealt with a isolated congregation, a community in somewhere, where rabs or stealers, a captive one of the members, and threatened that they're going to kill him. And the question is, how much should we collect from people? And transfer this question into the question where we are talking about an army, a commitment towards the soldiers to bring him back, the consequences of the morale all over the army, and the price that the state should pay, whatever. You know, you can't use those sources in order to say that the Jewish approach towards this question is that you have, it's halacha. The Mishnah says you shouldn't release Gilad Shalit. because אין פודים את השבועים יותר מכבי שוויין, and try now to make a משא ומתן and negotiate, maybe it's a different whatever. The gap between the sources that we have from our tradition and the current situation is too big and too wide and too deep that we can't take sources that dealt in one situation so far away and use them immediately without any conversion into our current situation. So that's one thing, and actually I claim it's not only the Gilad Shalit question. We have so many those kind questions that are dealing with the Jewish state, and we are asking ourselves, for instance, as a member, as a rabbi that was a member, I was in this committee not as a rabbi. I was in this committee and other committees as a expert in ethics. That was my job. But I constantly asked myself, as a rabbi, in a Jewish state, should you include medicine against quality of life? Not against, I mean that promote quality of life, even if it's a pikuach nefesh in other fields, or not? Should someone that is ill because he made wrong decisions, should you at least claim and at least force him to pay more, or not, because someone, a patient is a patient is a patient? I really don't have any Jewish sources that I can deal with. So now we are, that's one thing I want to say. And now we're facing two options. One is what Yeshaya Leibovich said years ago, 50 years ago, that the only way is to write a new Torah Shebal Peh. That's the only way. And if we are not, don't have the courage to do that, we don't deserve the dream, the vision about a Jewish state. That was his claim, and this was the reason everybody that knows his biography, I'm not sure you know the terms, but everybody that learns Tanakh will understand me, the gap between Yeshayahu HaRishon and Yeshayahu HaSheni. Yeshayahu HaRishon, he was a representative of the Zionist religious movement in the Histadrut, I mean in 1940, and etc. But he left, and he was opposed all the Zionist religious movement because of two reasons. One of them was the fact that he said that we actually are lying to ourselves. If we don't have the courage and if we don't have the ability to understand that a state is something new, and now you have to ask yourself, will the foreign office will be open on Shabbos to include medicine against quality of life in the basket? If to release Gilad Shalit, if you can attack terror, what will be, I spoke about it in Torat Chaim, how will a newspaper look like in a Jewish state where you have to balance between Isurei Lashon Hara and Isur Halbanat Panim, and from the other hand, Uvi'arta Hara Mikirbecha, from the other hand, Lo Ta'amod Al Dam Re'echa. And will a newspaper in a halachic state actually will only advertise Divrei Torah? Will a menu in a restaurant actually we'll have only pictures of rabbis without the recipe, without the menu? So all those questions, we have to give an answer. And as I said, one answer can be creation. Creativity, creation, establishment, whatever. We have to do something brand new. I disagree with that. I disagree with that because actually, if we'll adopt Yeshayahu Leibovich's opinion, that means that we cannot speak about continuity. That's not Jewish tradition. We'll take actually the Western world ideas that we live in this environment, in this culture, and actually we'll say it in Aramaic. Yeah, but the essence will be the same thing. So therefore, I disagree with the idea. What I want to claim is that if we understand that we can't make a direct transportation between sources from the Mishnah to our current situation, but we can start to find a process that will deal from the beginning that will use the idea. And the idea of this Mishnah is an idea that we can use also in this current situation. And that is, there are limits. And there is a price that, according to halacha, you are not permitted to pay. What is the price? Let's say I can think about, if it's a strategic price, not only the price of murders, but if it's changing the whole balance in the Middle East or in the society, whatever, so maybe this is a price that the halacha says you have to calculate and you have to ask yourself if you are permitted to pay. And you don't say this is the halacha because you don't know what's the halacha. You say that a thing that the music of the halacha will say no, will say yes, whatsoever. I'm not talking about now immediately. So I think that we can use our tradition in our old sources and try to figure out what is the music, what are the directions, what is the roadmap. Not halachically, you know, like we have, like I spoke about the schnitzel, but we can understand something from the Jewish tradition and take out of it something that we can apply in the current situation. Now, I'm going back. I raised the question, what to write to those Knesset members? What to write? I want to read it, the four questions, four details of the new draft. Should I support? And I'm not asking personally, I'm asking as a rabbi. And I was asked, at Soho, I'm now the head of this department in Soho, but Soho was asked to write a paper about this draft. And I'm mentioning again, this draft includes at least four details. One, you have to have a special majority. Two, their commitment, the terrorists' commitment, not to come back to terror. I can say, I don't know, doesn't make sense, but okay. Third, if they were already arrested in the past and were released and came back into terror, under no circumstances, you can release them. And four, that the government or the army, doesn't matter, will have to listen at least to give the opportunity to the families that were injured that they'll have a position in this process, and before making decisions, you'll have to listen to them. So, actually, I want to say, as I said before, I want to say two things and then to leave it to the audience. One, as I said before, from my experience, you know what, next time in Chas V'Shalom will happen something, the law will not take place. And if we'll have to, they'll change the law, because you really can't make decisions, strong decisions, if you permitted the heart to make the decisions when the case is coming in being reality. So I don't have a lot of respect to the idea of the law. I'm not sure, and I now want to express my opinion towards the law. One, I'm not sure that the law is the good structure to face this thing. I don't think it should be a law. It should be a committee. It should be a public discussion. And we should have a combined media and academic and rabbis and commanders in the army that will deal, create a kind of a public environment. But I don't think that a law is the tool to face the challenge and to face the Chas V'Shalom, the event of one soldier that was kidnapped. That's one thing. Let's say it's the law. I want to say four comments towards those four details. One is that the idea of having a special majority is a good idea. It's a good idea. We know it also in halacha. In halacha, even if the court is 23 people and the majority means 12 against 11, if we are talking about let's see, a death penalty. Okay, if you're talking about death penalty, you have to have 13 against 10. 12 against 11 is not enough. And so, therefore, as I said before, I think you can transfer this idea and to convert it into a situation, into the current situation, and say, yes, the idea of having a special majority in those kinds of decisions is reasonable, but it's not exactly, because when we speak about death penalty, if you will not execute him, so nothing will happen. If, in this case, if you will not release the soldier, the terrorists, so actually the soldier will stay in the hands of the terrorists. So it's not the same situation, but I can say very, in a very modest way and very carefully, that the idea behind a special majority is something that halacha supports. Okay, so therefore I think it's a good idea. Two, the idea of letting, forcing the terrorists to sign all kinds of contracts or all kinds of, I think it's really crazy. Because of two reasons. First, let's say they will sign. No. So, gesucht. As you know, as my grandmother used to say. So what? Well, actually, if you write it in the law, you actually say that you really believe that if someone, a murderer, is signing a commitment that he will never go back into terror, you should, that's one thing. But the second thing is that even if the signing has any meaning, but let's say that they will refuse to sign it, so we'll enable them to avoid releasing our soldier. If you think our soldiers should be released by releasing them and sending them to hell, so that's one thing. But I don't want to take, I don't want to give them the power to make the decisions for the state of Israel. The third one is not to release someone that was released already. I think that's a real good case. And I think this should be one of the main decisions, because I think I don't have to explain why. But the exact, I want to speak and to finally, eventually, I want to finish with the fourth point. And that's really very, very bothers me. And I'm going back to the committee, the medical committee. Because I don't think that our problem is the families that were injured by those terrorists. I don't think it's our obligation towards them. My daughter-in-law, her father was murdered by a terrorist near Otniel years ago when she was six. She was 8 years old, something like this. She didn't know really her father. Her mother is a widow since then. And I know it very, you know, personally. We are very close to the family, and we are very... So I know the situation. But saying that means that the only problem is what happened. But if you think about it, the rejection against releasing terrorists is the future. It's not those that were injured already. It's the fact that in the future there'll be new ones. So therefore, giving a special position to the people that were already injured actually dismiss the case and argues against releasing them. Well, yesterday someone quoted a very famous journalist that wrote that, you know what, after all the discussions, the fact that all Israel celebrated Yigal Shalit's coming back home is the most important thing. You know what? I want to belong to the nation that celebrates the fact that one soldier came back, and not to belong to those murders. And I said, my response was, I don't want to destroy the party. But the celebration in Israel is a current situation, and temporarily. Because the first time that one of those terrorists that were released will suicide in a Chas V'Shalom, in a bus, and 16 people will be killed, then Israel is very fast to, you heard me, Israel is very fast to change the mind, and all the the celebration will immediately will convert into attacking, and we said so and whatever. So let's celebrate, but let's always be careful of thinking about what happened in the past. We have to think about the future. And I think that including this idea that the families that were injured will have a special position in this case actually dismisses, as I said, the main argue against releasing those terrorists. So what did I want to say? I want to say two things. One, it's very easy to say, oh, it's a complicated issue, and you knew it before I started. So therefore, and I want to say again that I think that every argue that was made, that was said, is reasonable. I can't even figure out one claim that was said that doesn't have any logic or anything in it. But we must continue thinking about the consequences, about the results, and every decision cannot be isolated from all the processes that this decision will cause. That's one thing that I wanted to say, and I think that I demonstrated from my experience in the Medicine Basket Committee, and I transferred it, shifted to the decision about Yigal Shalit, and I think it's very interesting that all kinds of decisions actually are the same. Second, is that I think that trying to claim that there is a Torani, this is a halachic approach towards Gilad Shalit, I think it's exaggerating. And I think it's even very dangerous, because using sources thinking about the gap that is between the old sources and our current situation, means that we can come to all kinds of so strange decisions because we didn't think about the differences. From the other hand, throwing them out and creating a new Yahadut, I think, is a wrong thing to do. But if we are using the music or the old sources as a roadmap, and we are thinking about all the consequences, as I said, then maybe we can find something that will say that there is, in the Jewish tradition, limits, and there are boundaries, and there are decisions that we have to have the courage to make, even if the price that will be paid is a high price, and we lose one soldier, and it's not losing the soldier. It will affect the army, the morale, the a lot of things. We have to think about everything. But we can't say that the Jewish tradition actually demands from the leadership to say enough is enough, somewhere. And I don't think you can go down into details, but you can say this thing as a roadmap towards the Israeli government or the Israeli Knesset. As I said, I hope I wanted to share with you my debate, how to answer. I'm going to answer this later tonight in my flight. So I wanted to share with you what actually will be my answer. I hope that this law will not be accepted by the Knesset. I hope that the law will not be the language or the discourse that Israel will think about the future. But if the law will be, at least, that my comments will be taken in thoughts, and that it will have some influence on Chas v'Shalom the next time. The only thing I can say that hopefully we will never face such a situation, not a captive soldier, and definitely not the situation where an army commander will give the order to shoot on the group that is kidnapping an Israeli soldier. You know, thinking about it is really something that I hope that we'll never, never, never face such a situation. And hopefully, this next time we'll deal with better, with happier issues in this Torah in Motion convention. Thank you. What's the time? Because Pnina? Okay. I know. What's the time? 3 o'clock? So two questions, okay? Yeah. I can go back to the mic. Yeah, thanks.
In North America, we talked about President Truman, I think it was looking for a one-armed economist.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, just to say on the one hand, on the other hand, it's a complete cop-out. This is a decision and a question that has to be dealt with. To say that all these issues, which are wonderful, it's a lovely analytic discussion, but it doesn't deal with the issue. And any set of laws, constitutional law, where they deal with issues that have not presented themselves, may never present with themselves for 1,000 years, using the words of the original law, you have what's called living tree doctrines, or some kind of jurisprudential explanation of how you do this, but you have to do it.
Okay, so I have three comments I want to say. The first thing, I agree, and I said there should be a decision. We made a decision in the Basket Medicine Committee. We made a decision in Gilad Shalit's questions. First of all, you're right. I didn't say the only. Okay, that's one thing. The second comment is, what should be the formulate of the decision? Should we decide now what will be in the future, and actually, when the future will chas v'shalom come, we will not be able to fulfill our decision or to apply our decisions that we made. And I know the situation in Israel because, as you know, a law in Israel is a recommendation. It's not something that you should take too seriously. So I'm talking about real Israel. Or should we say, let's not make this decision now. Let's educate. Let's argue. Let's erase all the influence and all the consequences of this issue. And let's decide who will be the group that will decide next time. Okay? And they'll have to have a special, what will be the structure, but not the essence of the decision. That's my recommendation. Okay? And it's not, when the situation will come, we'll have to make decisions. You're right. And the third one is that I think that the idea, the decision should be the last thing we do. And before now, nothing is pressing us to make those decisions. And it's better to have a long-term discussion that will erase and will be able to see the consequences of the last, Gilad Shalit story, before we make. So I think that this draft is actually too fast. So these are my three comments. I agree that we have to make decisions. I think that to make those decisions in advance, in the situation, current situation in Israel, is better to make the decision what will be the structure, but not what will be the essence of the decision. And third, I think that the discussion is very important. Even if we want to make a decision in advance, I think that the discussion should be longer. And not, we are not now urged by any case to make the decisions immediately. That's my comments.
We are urged because the soldiers have to decide how to react.
Okay.
It is urgent.
Okay. Shela chona? Yeah.
I just wanted to say that it reminded me of the whole issue of victims' rights, when especially we were talking about the last point, a topic that's, I'm sure, an issue in Israel, especially with the whole public relations machine that was behind Gilad Shalit. And you can imagine public relations machines being behind the people with the Hunter's disease and everything else. And I think, as you said, that it's up to the government to think about it in terms of, are we talking about justice from the government, or are we talking about vigilante justice from one group against another?
You're right. I don't have anything to say. Okay, thank you very much. I want to take the advantage to But the problem that Pnina, we have an opportunity to hear another presentation, so I think it's better than to... You heard me, Ella. Thank you.